Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. Before the attacks of 9/11, not much thought had been given to the idea that someone would intentionally target things like power plants or water supplies or communications systems, these kinds of systems that we rely on to be there and to work. And we rely on them really without thinking about them very much. They're systems that were designed to work well for maximum efficiency at minimum cost. And as a result, these kinds of services that we depend on every day are, in fact, vulnerable to attack. So the question we want to talk about a little bit this morning is how we go shielding these service networks that we depend on that are important individually and that are tangled up all together. Our guest for the program is Thomas Mackin. He's professor and chair of the Department of Mechanical Engineering at California Polytechnic and State University. That's in San Luis Obispo in California. He is also adjunct professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering Sciences here at University of Illinois. In fact, back from 1993 until 2005, he was first assistant, then associate professor of mechanical engineering here at the U of I. In 2004, he also became director of the Illinois Homeland Security Research Center, which is affiliated with the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security. And there it was an effort to bring together people from various disciplines with various kinds of backgrounds all to look at this particular issue of homeland security as it applies specifically to the state of Illinois. He's here spending some time with us this morning, and we're pleased to have him on the program. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep moving along, but anyone is welcome to pick up the telephone and give us a call. Thanks very much for being here.
All right. Thank you, David, for having me.
It seems kind of hard to believe, really, that for such a long time, and I think probably, although I'm sure some people have given some had given some thought to it, not the way we do now, before 9/11, that these kinds of systems that we depend on, municipal water systems and the critical nodes for the phone system and the power system, were for all intents and purposes completely undefended. If someone wanted deliberately to damage them, they pretty much could have just walked right up to them and done it. And it seems kind of hard to believe that that was the case before 9/11.
Well, it's true. I mean, we operate with an assumption of civility and a general belief in an open society. And so there's no doubt about it. We have a very large infrastructure, a physical infrastructure that supports our standard of living. And we had not thought very much about defending that infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And so it was quite a wake-up call on 9/11. But it's unclear exactly how we can defend that infrastructure because the infrastructure is so gigantic. I have just a few comments I'd like to make about that to give you an idea of the size of the physical infrastructure. And this is just touching on it, just barely touching the surface. We have 168,000 public water systems, 300,000 oil and natural gas production sites, 177,000 miles of oil pipeline, about 1.3 million miles of natural gas pipeline, 4 million miles of public roads, 582,000 bridges, 18,700 general aviation airports. So that's just the tip of the iceberg. The infrastructure is gigantic, and no one ever even thought about trying to protect that infrastructure. And even now that we're thinking about it, it's clear that we cannot protect all of it. We have to make some very carefully considered choices about what we will protect. And that's the idea of figuring out what is truly critical, which is really quite a challenging problem.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about that. How do you do that? How do you determine what is? Obviously, you damage one of these systems, people are going to be affected. People in the immediate area who depend on the system are going to be affected. And I suppose that one of the issues is looking at how many people are affected, how widespread this is, and you try to look at those places where the greatest number of people are affected, and that's where you start.
Yes. Again, you're talking about a very difficult and challenging problem, and because the infrastructure is so large, it was decided early on that the only way we could tackle this problem is to use a risk-based approach. And that is, if the listeners have a pencil handy, risk is equal to the threat towards an asset times the vulnerability of that asset times the consequences if that asset happens to be hit. Mm-hmm. This is a standard risk definition, a standard risk equation. And what you do is you really create a database of your entire infrastructure, and then you use a risk modeling methodology to decide, okay, how can I best invest my limited resources to bring the risk down? It's a very difficult process, and we're in the middle of that process right now.
Well, it would seem to take, you know, just take one thing. The first thing on your list of infrastructure there is public water systems. There are lots and lots and lots of them. And I suppose there, if you'd say, with your system, you'd say, well, do we need to do something to protect it? Right away, I guess I would say, well, you would have to consider two things. One is how many people it serves, and the other would be, well, what's the likelihood that someone's going to attack our water system? And it seems so simply by that rule, you would have to say, well, maybe I would be much more worried about the water system that serves the city of Chicago than I would be about the one that serves Champaign-Urbana. Not to say someone wouldn't attack Champaign-Urbana. You might even say, ah, see, they're not going to be expecting Champaign-Urbana, so that's where we're going to go. But basically, you're going to say, well, you know, if you're a terrorist, you get the maximum bang for your buck. You want to go where the most people are going to be affected. So right away, that says, if I'm a big city, I should be concerned about this.
Well, you're right. And in fact, bringing up the public water sector is an important one first to talk about, because right after 9/11, there was a lot of hype about protecting our public water infrastructure. And when people looked very carefully at it, they found that it would be very, very hard to tamper with, because it takes huge quantities of additives in a public water supply to actually have an effect. You know, this notion of the solution to pollution is dilution. Well, the water supplies are enormous. And so it's very difficult to actually attack a water supply. So you again, when you look at the risk equation, look at threat, vulnerability, and consequences, the vulnerability of the water system is actually quite low. And so a lot of people have concluded that it is a complete waste of money to try to protect water supplies, even though some people have actually spent money on trying to protect water supplies. And so this is an important thing. We really need to consider all of these aspects of the risk equation and really make a very carefully considered decision about how vulnerable is that asset, mm-hmm. and what are the real consequences of attacking that asset. Now, I need to bring something up here, because people who work in the risk area like to do calculations of financial risk. And if you're going to do calculations of financial risk, as long as you're dealing with physical things like buildings or pipes, it's pretty easy to figure out how much it would cost to repair or replace those components. But we have to consider also that lives could be lost. And if you're going to do a risk equation, the real trouble that people have is you have to put a value on life, and that's a very difficult thing to do. Or you can do a casualty equation. You can do it that way. Mm-hmm. So this is a challenging problem. It's not an easy problem to solve. But if we're going to get any real return on the investment that we're making, we have to take it out of the political arena and do our best job to try to figure out the optimum investment scheme to reduce the threat of terrorism.
Yeah. Well, you know, something else, and I have a caller here, I promise we'll get to them right in a second, but something else that I think one of the points that we really wanted to make and discuss was the way in which these individual systems are connected.
Yeah.
So that affecting one will have an effect on the other. And it just, as an example, just now comes to mind here. Within the last couple of years in Champaign-Urbana, we had a boil order. It was the first time in all the, I've lived here 30 years, the first time in Champaign-Urbana. And it happened not because there was something particularly wrong with the water system. It was because there was a power outage that affected a particular, as I remember, it affected a pumping station. The pressure dropped below a certain level. And so you get at that point, you get a concern. So it caused, well, some might say minimal disruption, but it caused some disruption because everybody ran out to buy bottled water and you had to boil your water. And this was the way a problem with one system affected another. And that was just a very small kind of example. So you would have to think now, well, okay, if you want to attack infrastructure, maybe you look at some aspect of it that not only has factors just limited to itself, but something that is attached to all kinds of other things.
No, you're absolutely right. This is the whole problem of interdependencies. And you just got at a really good one there, the interdependency of power with lots of other of our critical sectors. That's a huge one. Another good example of an interdependency is there is a very large coal-fired power generation plant in Missouri that gets the vast majority of its coal by rail, and the vast majority of that coal comes from Wyoming, and it crosses a single bridge in Wyoming. If you take out that bridge, you shut down the power generation plant in Missouri. And so the tough part about the Department of Homeland Security faces this issue of how are they going to allocate resources? Well, how many people in Missouri are going to want to spend money on a bridge in Wyoming? But the truth of the matter is, you should send your money to that bridge in Wyoming because you need to protect that bridge so that you can run your power plant. So this is a very interesting problem that this tries to take it out of the take too much politics out of the equation. I mean, there's a lot of politics in the equation, and using a risk-based approach helps you deal a little bit with the politics that enter the equation. The politics have a tendency to, let's say, tamper with how the best way to allocate resources. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Tom Mackin. He's a professor, chair of the Department of Mechanical Engineering at Cal Polytechnic and State University in San Luis Obispo. He's also adjunct professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering here at the U of I and was on faculty here in mechanical engineering for a number of years. We're talking about the kinds of infrastructure that we depend on every day here in the United States and the vulnerability to attack of that infrastructure and also something about the how it's even more complicated because it's linked. There are links between the various aspects of the infrastructure to the extent that it's possible that if you damage one system one place, it will have effect on other systems as well. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller, someone here in Urbana where we are, line number one.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised you aren't talking about nuclear plants. I mean, especially being from Illinois, I don't know how many we have, but it's certainly the most in the nation. And a single nuclear plant compromise would involve agriculture, people, water, everything. And I guess the most recent decision was for containment, not protection. I find this bizarre.
Nuclear plants are a very important part of the protection equation. I believe there are six of them in Illinois. It is something – I have to tell you that a lot of the protection methodologies come out from a history of protection of nuclear power plants. Nuclear power plants are probably the best protected infrastructure that we have right now. Chemical plants are actually much more vulnerable than nuclear power plants. They're built with enormous containment vessels, and there were a number of studies done before and after 9/11 on how difficult it might be to breach a containment vessel, and they did actually consider collisions of aircraft with nuclear containment vessels as well. The difficult part, the plants themselves are really fairly secure from external attack. Their security has been beefed up considerably. There's always the issue of the insider. That's the biggest problem that you have with infrastructures that are rather well protected physically. Insider threat is the biggest threat you have. The other threat actually is to the storage. And because we're not shipping a lot of our spent fuel to very secure storage areas, we're keeping a lot of that spent fuel on site. And that's probably the trickiest one to deal with right now.
Mm-hmm. And is that now here, just to make sure people understand what happens is as you use the nuclear reaction to generate electricity, you end up with this highly radioactive spent fuel.
Yes.
There has been this plan now that's been dragging on for decades. The federal government planned to build a facility to hold it out in the West, Yucca Mountain, and it's been delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed. And what has happened is that the people who generate the waste, like the power companies, the government simply said to them, "You got to hold on to this stuff until we have a place to put it." So now, at the power plants where the material has been produced, essentially, there everybody is just sitting on the stuff until the day comes when there is this federal repository, and apparently nobody really knows when that day is going to be.
The day seems to get pushed back every week.
Yeah. So there's significant amounts of this stuff. What is this just dangerous in and of itself because it's highly radioactive, or could you? So are you talking about dirty bomb stuff, or are you talking about something that you could actually use to make a nuclear weapon?
I'm not an expert in this area, but the problem is this is all a temporary storage solution. This isn't a permanent storage solution. And so whenever you're involved in a temporary storage solution on site, you're unlikely to invest as much in it. Now, there's lots of physical security with perimeter guards, a lot of enhancement of guarding, but nonetheless, the containment for the spent fuel has been identified by most people. Now, not the cask storage for transportation. That is actually very secure. It's the on-site storage that, again, I don't want to alarm anybody. It's not that it's not secure, mm-hmm. but the plant itself, the reactor itself, is actually more secure than the waste.
Yeah. It seems to me that if, you know, of these many systems that we depend on, obviously, if you damage one of them, local effects could be very dramatic, and then cascading effects could be also dramatic. But it seems that if you ask this question, well, are there hierarchy of these systems? Is there something or things that if you affect that, you've really got a serious problem? And it seems to me the answer that must be yes, and that I would think that the thing that would be on the very top would be electricity, because so much of what everything we use is dependent on electricity to power it. And if you don't have electricity, you don't have you don't have power, you don't have light, can't run the pumps for the water system, you may not have telephone service, you're not going to have the internet, that if you could do something to interrupt the supply of electric power, that would be extremely serious and, of course, would affect a lot of other systems as well.
No, it is true, except the one thing you have to keep in mind is that we do have a lot of experience with repairing lost power, reconfiguring after we lose power. We had a very large blackout in the Northeast because of a transmission line failure that created a cascading failure as a number of power plants shut down because they simply had to stop generating electricity. And we dealt with that fairly quickly. Yes, it's disruptive. There's no doubt about it. But within 24 hours, usually within 24 hours, we have electricity back up and supplied to the vast majority of households. And we deal with this every time there's a hurricane as well. So it is a vulnerable system, but it is a system that we know how to repair rather well. There are certain parts of the electricity system, though, that are particularly troublesome. There are certain transformers. You may recall that we used to build transformers in the United States. We do not build them in the United States anymore. Mm-hmm. They're built overseas in Germany and China. And a number of transformers are one-off specialty designs. And so if you lose one of those very specialized transformers, you can take from 3 months to a year to actually replace it. Now, after 9/11, Electrical Liability Council decided that in some of these key transformers, we should actually build backups before we lost them. And so there was an effort, and I don't know how far that went, but there was an effort to actually have spares available because we found that after 9/11, there were a number of key transformers where we did not have spares. And a really good example of this is actually out in the California Water Project, where they have to pump huge amounts of water into L.A. over the Tehachapi Mountains. And not only are the pumps unique, there are one-off designs, but the transformers for those pumps are unique as well. And so there's a system where losing power causes you to lose water. And if someone were to target very specific locations in California, it could be offline for 6 months, which would be a disaster.
Yeah. Well, how well, are we protecting the information about these systems so that, you know, say if somebody wanted to do that, how easy would it be for them to determine where the vulnerable point was so that they would know, okay, if I want to do this and I want to cause maximum sort of disruption, I need to go to this place to do that?
Well, I'm sorry for laughing. We have a very open society, let's face it. A lot of information is in the public domain. It's either in the public domain today. You can Google things and get a lot of information. You can use Google Earth to get a very good idea of where some key assets happen to be. Information is generally available. If it's not available today, it was available a short time ago, and many people believe that if it's been out there, it's been downloaded, and so it's still out there. So if those who wish to do us harm are using a targeting approach similar to what the U.S. military uses, they would identify key nodes in our infrastructure, and they would go for them. It's not clear, though, that we have a complete handle on the motivations of our adversaries in this particular case. It's not clear at all, because there are a number of people who've talked about we have a number of soft targets, very vulnerable targets that have not been attacked. So people are dismayed, in fact, in the security community. They're like, they don't quite understand why some of these targets have not been attacked. But that may be due to the fact that we simply don't understand our enemy.
Well, it seems that if you were concerned about the possibility of attack, that there are a couple of things you could do. Maybe the obvious thing that you could do would be to identify the place that's likely to be attacked, and then to design a defense, whether that would mean putting a big building around it or putting a fence around it or putting guards there or, you know, something like a physical kind of defense, which seems to me actually to be limited in its effectiveness, although, you know, that might help. That maybe what would make more sense is that once you've identified what your nodes are, assume that it will be attacked. Say to yourself, okay, we know that let's just say it's going to be attacked. The best kind of defense that we can mount is to make sure that reduce the criticality of that node. Say, okay, if it's attacked, we can work around. We can we all have our parts we need to replace it. We do everything we can to eliminate the possibility of cascading effects. So if we have a problem there, we isolate it as much as possible. We look at the interconnections maybe between that and other systems, and in a sense say there's no way that we can protect it. What we need to do is to make sure that we can cope with the attack when it comes.
No, you're absolutely right. That's part of the national strategy. And that you're actually uncovering something very interesting now, and that is you can either try to protect all of your assets or you try to build in some resiliency into mm-hmm. your system. And a number of us have been arguing recently that since we are spending so much money on homeland security, we should make sure that it's dual-use money. And perhaps what we should be doing is investing in enhancing the resiliency of our infrastructure. For instance, our power distribution system is incredibly antiquated and incredibly vulnerable, the power lines that do the transmission, and there's no incentive to invest in that. And so some people have thought about, well, maybe we should build in some added resiliency and added redundancy by creating some incentives to enhance the transmission, the electric transmission system. Or maybe we should build in some redundancies to build some new bridges in some key locations so that if a bridge was taken out, we would have some alternate routes. And so you're really getting at the heart of a key issue that I believe we're going to be struggling with over the next few years. And that is, again, how do we invest the money in homeland security to best effect? And the other truth here is that no matter how you do it, you're going to be open to criticism, because if you prevent attacks, people will say, well, you wasted your money because there was no attack. So it's a very interesting game. If you do your job right, you enhance the resiliency of the system, and they say, well, you know, it wasn't so critical after all. So it's a very interesting problem that we have to face. But a number of us are really pushing for resiliency and redundancy now.
Yeah. Well, it seems, though, that, again, this is another one of those arguments should bolster the argument that we should be, on general principles, we should be investing in infrastructure, and that we do have these systems. We do depend on them. Things happen. You know, the particular case that people remember for now, some years back when there was the big power outage in the Northeast, that wasn't because somebody attacked it deliberately.
No,
it just happened. And then immediately after that, people were saying, say, the electricity grid, it's old, it's overtaxed, it's vulnerable to breaking down, and we really need to invest some serious money into rehabbing and strengthening that system. And we talked about that for a while, and then we went on to talk about something else. And now, you know, from time to time, people come back to that and say, you know, remember that thing that happened? That could happen again, and we really need to pay attention to it. But the problem is that it means spending money, and that it's just, you know, those things, water systems and roads and the electricity grid, that's kind of a boring, wonky topic, you know? People aren't really that much interested in it, but because a variety of things could happen to it and we depend on it, you know, we obviously should be taking care of it, and we're not.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, we're relying upon an infrastructure that was built quite some time ago by people who had a lot of foresight, and now we seem to have short attention spans, and it's rare that we invest in new infrastructure. But there is another tricky part in this, and that is that a large part of the infrastructure, people estimate 85% of it, is privately held. And others say, well, how should we be spending federal dollars on enhancing an infrastructure that is privately held? And so that there's another very important issue. We depend upon it. We rely on it every day of our lives. But who's responsible for protecting it? Who's responsible for upgrading it?
We have a couple callers here, and we'll continue to talk with our guest, Tom Macklin. He is professor and chair of the Department of Mechanical Engineering at California Polytechnic and State University in San Luis Obispo. He's also adjunct professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering here at the U of I, where he was on faculty for a number of years. We're talking about the issue of infrastructure and its vulnerability to attack and what we need to do about that. 333-9455, toll-free 800-2 229455 over to Belgium, not too far away. Line number 4 for our caller right here. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Good morning. I'd like to approach this from slightly a different concept if I could. And that's the fact that at least here I am, I'm somewhat parochial in my points of view, I have to admit. But it seems as though we as Americans are frightened to death to have any problems of how can I put it? We don't want to have anything go wrong. We're very adverse to risk in any way, shape, or form. Where, you know, many places in this world, they don't have this kind of infrastructure, and they go on with their lives, and maybe it's not as glorious of a life as we have in America, but they live, and they die, and they move on with their lives, and their children grow up. But yet, every day, we have to be held so we don't have any risk. And if we do have some kind of risk, we want to be made whole because we've been damaged. And do we really need a lifestyle like that, that we have to worry about all the things you're talking about?
Now, you know, you bring up a very important point, and risk communication is something essential. I actually agree with you. I think that we are very risk averse. We're averse to risk that is imposed upon us. Yet we drive cars every day, and your risk of death in an automobile accident is much larger than your risk of death in a terrorist attack. And so perhaps we have overreacted. You could certainly say there are a lot of people who have argued that we have certainly overreacted. You may recall that during the last presidential election, John Kerry had the audacity, some called it the audacity, to say that Homeland Security should be a law enforcement issue. You know, and a lot of people actually do agree with them that we didn't necessarily need to create an entirely new agency to deal with this sort of Homeland Security threat. And I agree with you. I mean, it's always astonishing to me that in Israel, there will be an attack at a bus stop, and later that day, people are at the bus stop. And so there's an understanding of living with risk and deciding that it's not going to disrupt the way you live, nor is it going to control the way you live or the decisions that you make. I think you have a very good point. I don't know if I have the quote right, but Benjamin Franklin, you could Google it and look it up. You know, he said he would deny an essential liberty for lowering their risk deserves neither liberty nor security. And so one of our founding fathers really talked about how you cannot be too risk-averse in your life.
Yeah, exactly. And get to the point where to use an example, we all go through a lot of hassles to get onto an airplane today for a very minor amount of risk.
Yeah, I think you're right there.
Very few people, I mean, it's horrible that they did fly into the World Trade Center, but very, very few people in the relationship to all that have happened really were involved with this. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, let's go to Champagne. This is line 1. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. It seems like one way to cope with these kinds of problems, or at least minimize them, is greater decentralization. I know that, of course, you know, like utilities wouldn't like the idea of everybody having solar panels on their, you know, roofs and geothermal units sunk into their yards and things like that, but that would certainly, you know, reduce the dependency on a centralized source for electricity. And there are a lot of other things that could probably be decentralized to a great extent. And I remember it seems like, you know, electronic data is something that would be very vulnerable to attack. Wasn't that many years ago that heavy snows, I believe it was in New Jersey, collapsed the roof of, you know, one of the two, I guess there were only two sort of processing nodes that handled the ATMs for all the eastern part of the United States, and it caused, you know, some havoc. And that way, it seems like some disruption to commerce through not being able to communicate electronically, which so much commerce is handled that way today, would be, you know, have a big dent in the economy as well.
Well, you're bringing up a very important point. Centralization does increase your vulnerability, but some people argue that if we centralize, then we can put all of our protection in that central location. So it makes it easier to protect, but it also makes it more critical so that if it is hit, it causes more problems. I think you're right. There are lots of people pushing for greater distribution. And energy is one of those examples, actually, of a more distributed generation system. But you're bringing up again a very, very important point, and it's important also to note that government policies often drive the way these things become centralized and the way our infrastructure evolves. And so we need to better understand, I believe, and there are some efforts underway to better understand the effects of policy on how infrastructure evolves. And so you bring up a very good point, and I agree with you.
Well, I think a lot of times policy has more to do with crony capitalism, or at least just, you know, looking out for the interest of a wealthy few who, you know, have benefit from having their policies go a certain way that doesn't really have much to do with the benefit to, you know, society as a whole. Thank you.
I know you have, a good point. But I think you would really like a book. It's called The Next Catastrophe by Charles Perrow, where he really talks about the policy issues that are the backbone of the way some of the infrastructure was built. And he's a very, very big advocate of distributing the infrastructure and creating more resiliency in the infrastructure, and really spends a lot of time discussing the policy issues associated with the evolution of the infrastructure.
Well, here, talk a little bit about the it seems that here the natural, if at no other level, the natural place to be talking about this is on the level of the federal government, and that from the very top there ought to be recognition that this is a very important question, and here it's natural for the federal government to be involved in it. And certainly people were indeed thinking about this before 9/11. I know I sort of suggested that nobody was thinking about this. Well, it's not true that nobody was thinking about it, but it wasn't an issue on the level that it is now, that it has been since then. So what has actually been going on the federal level in terms of thinking about infrastructure, its critical vulnerability, and then what should be done to protect it?
Oh, my goodness. Well, with the formation of the Department of Homeland Security, we merged 21 agencies. And you may recall that when that happened, there was a lot of discussion about how ineffective that organization would be. And that organization has since struggled to become effective. There's no doubt about it. The way resources were allocated in the early days was not at all transparent. There was not a risk-based assessment being done to allocate resources to best effect. It was political cronyism, as was mentioned by one of the callers. And Secretary Chertoff has pushed for a risk-based approach. But when that was implemented, it was implemented as a black box, so that certain cities got money and other cities did not, and it really upset various jurisdictions that they didn't get money when they felt they had critical infrastructure to protect. And when they asked the Department of Homeland Security, they would say, well, here's what we want you to protect, but we aren't going to tell you why. And so there was a lack of communication as well. So it's a huge organization that is struggling to become effective. It's not clear whether or not it will become effective. It's going to take some really strong leadership. And the way it evolved is also another important issue. It evolved from what was at first an Office of Homeland Security under the executive branch, that was under presidential control, to a Department of Homeland Security, which had various appropriations committees associated with it under congressional control. And so that sort of struggle for control between the various branches of government, the legislative and the executive, had an impact on how this evolved and how effective it turned out to be. I would say right now it's struggling to be effective, and there's a lot of first responders out there, a lot of really great people. In fact, by the way, state of Illinois has done a fantastic job through their managing their homeland security. The Illinois Terrorism Task Force is incredibly effective. This is a model for the nation. But if you talk to these people, you'll find that they're very frustrated by their relationship with the Department of Homeland Security.
Well, that was just the next question that I was thinking about, is that, yes, that there certainly should be a natural role here for federal government, but also that state governments and local governments have the same kinds of concerns, and that there must be conflict over who is responsible for what and who's going to make the rules. And if money's got to be spent, where that money is going to come from. Certainly, I'm sure that there's that kind of conflict between the federal government and the individual state governments.
Oh, there is. And you may remember in the early days of this color-coded threat warning system, I mean, my God, every time they raised the threat level, local agencies, local jurisdictions would have to send people out on patrol and pay overtime. And where was the money coming from? It absolutely drove them crazy. And they wanted actionable intelligence. They wanted to know why they were doing what they were doing. They wanted it to be localized. They wanted it to be more specific. And they were right. It was crazy to raise the threat level nationally and just say, hey, everybody has to put more police officers on duty and pay overtime, when there was really no resources to pay for that. It's evolved. It's gotten better. It's still not working as effectively as it could. But there is something else I want to bring up here, mm-hmm. and that is this this notion of centralization and decentralizing. There's another important issue that arises, and the really good example of this is liquefied natural gas. There are a small number of offload sites for liquefied natural gas, and you know that America has a very large appetite for energy, and so we use a lot of gas, and we need to ship in a fair amount of natural gas, and the vast majority of the offload sites are in the Gulf of Mexico, Port of Beaumont, Texas, and off the coast of Louisiana. That is an incredibly centralized network that is incredibly vulnerable. Okay, but what happens is when they want to license a new facility, like for instance in the Northeast, which uses a lot of natural gas, there, a lot of people say, not in my backyard. And so this is a really huge issue. If we wanted to decentralize and make the system less vulnerable, we have to have a more distributed offloading capability. But if we're going to have a more distributed offloading capability, it's going to be in somebody's backyard. And that is an incredibly difficult problem to solve. And I'm not sure that any of us know how to solve that problem. Does the federal government impose a site licensing plan that enhances the resiliency of our new distributed network? I think that's a very tough question to answer. I'm sorry I'm bringing up new questions here, but these are the issues that arise when you're trying to deal with protecting our infrastructure.
Our guest, let me introduce again our guest, and we'll take another caller. Thomas Mackin, he's professor and chair of the Department of Mechanical Engineering at California Polytechnic and State University in San Luis Obispo, California. He's also adjunct professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering Sciences at the U of I for a number of years, from 1993 until 2005. He was first assistant, then associate professor of mechanical engineering here at U of I. In 2004, he became director of the Illinois Homeland Security Research Center, which is affiliated with with the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security here on the campus of the U of I. And we're talking about protecting critical infrastructure. We have about 10 minutes left. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Charleston. Line number four. Hello.
Yes. What I'm about to quote coalesces with the previous caller's allusion to crony capitalism. Before and during World War I lived a lady, Rosa Luxemburg, and her quote was, "We shall have communism or we shall have barbarism." And I'm afraid the latter is the case. Thank you.
Well, all right. You may comment on that any way you like.
We have a political system where some could argue that our representatives are trying to do things for their constituents in finding ways to channel resources back to their district that they represent. And so some people would say they're doing their job. The more money they bring back to the district, the better they're doing their job. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's doing anything for the nation necessarily, and it's certainly not the most effective way to allocate resources when you have such a gigantic infrastructure like we have right now. So it's something that we've got to fix. There is a huge amount of pushback against the Department of Homeland Security in adopting the risk-based approaches, not amongst the boots-on-the-ground practitioners. Look, most of the people who are doing the daily job of protecting our country are incredibly dedicated people who work long hours selflessly doing their job. So I really, my hat's off to all those people who are doing the job every day. But they aren't always getting the resources that they need, nor have those resources been properly prioritized to make sure they're protecting what is most vulnerable. But we need to bring up another very important issue here in the whole risk-based approach. We talked about how risk is equal to threat times vulnerability times consequences. Consequences it can be tricky because of loss of life and how you value loss of life. Consequences can also be tricky because it's very difficult to understand the economic or psychological consequences of an attack. The classic example that people use all the time is the backpack terrorist attack in a mall on that first shopping day after Thanksgiving, for instance. Suppose we, four malls. I mean, what the economic fallout from that, some people say, could be gigantic. And it's hard to understand what that fallout would be. So it's difficult to actually be accurate in your calculation of consequences. The vulnerability is something we can be fairly accurate about, and that is, given a particular attack scenario, how likely is it to be successful? That we can do a pretty good job of that. But the other key component here is threat. And if there's no threat, if no one is targeting an asset, you don't have to spend any money protecting that asset. And so threat information, intel, is incredibly important in all of this. And intel is where we've had a lot of problems. So there's actually a company in Champaign-Urbana that people need to know about, Riverglass, which does a lot of very interesting work with the Illinois State Police and other agencies and jurisdictions in the country. And they're really working on trying to ferret out some of this threat issue that we believe, those of us, I also do work at the Naval Postgraduate School in the Center for Homeland Defense and Security. We believe that some of the work that Riverglass is doing would be very important in this whole threat piece in risk analysis.
And we'll talk again with another caller, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. You brought up earlier the problem with decentralization of the natural gas facilities or liquefied natural gas, but that's a problem with more general things as well. I remember that during the California power shortage problems, there was talk about the need to build a new large-scale power transmission facilities, and that there was a terrible problem because with a power plant, you put it in one place. With a transmission line, you put it in thousands of people's backyard. Has there been any kind of progress on the on ways to streamline that approach, because that's a big barrier?
Wow, that is an interesting question. And boy, do you bring up a very important... California sort of is proud of the fact that they have no coal-fired power plants. But if you look carefully at the border of California, there's a lot of coal-fired power plants just across the border in Nevada. And so they're sort of gaming the system a little bit in importing their power from Nevada. Boy, in terms of they are investing in new distribution lines in California. They're putting it down Interstate 5, and they were lucky in that that particular transmission route did not have a lot of houses along it. It's the Central Valley. It has a huge amount of agriculture. And so they were lucky. So I do not think that that problem has been solved. It is a huge problem. In San Luis Obispo, we're facing that problem with actually a new water pipeline that's supposed to come from Lake Nacimiento to San Luis Obispo. And there's a lot of private property owners who don't want anyone digging up their yards, putting a pipeline in to distribute water. So I cannot tell you that the problem has been solved. I think in some cases, we've been fortunate in that the routes that were chosen did not have a lot of opposition. So we will probably end up choosing non-optimal routes to minimize the opposition.
Does that get at your question, caller?
Thank you. That answers my question.
All right. We're coming down here. We have a couple of minutes left. I'm thinking about, and this in a sense goes in a very different direction, but I'm thinking about the comments of some of the callers that seem to suggest here that part of the one thing that we need to think about is how dependent on infrastructure we are and what kind of services we expect to have in our daily lives, how much we depend on them, and how long we feel willing and able to go without them. And this is the kind of thing that comes up from time to time when we talk about the possibility of there being natural disaster. The standard advice is that we give people from time to time, and it could be because of a tornado or earthquake or hurricane or whatever, that there's a period of time when people are going to have to be able to take care of themselves, so, which makes you start asking questions about, well, okay, what of these things could I get along with and how long? You know, how long could I do without electrical power? How long could I do without water? How long could I do without being able to make a phone call? How long could I do without being able to have the internet? And as I say, I realize this is in a sense a different kind of question. And yet it seems to be, the demand is ties into criticality. And that may be one thing that we should be at least thinking a little bit about is there some way that we can actually reduce our, to some degree, maybe small, but to some degree actually reduce our dependence on these systems?
Well, again, I mentioned this book by Charles Perrow, The Next Catastrophe. He talks a lot about this. He talks a lot about reducing our dependency. I think that's a very difficult question for me to answer. I find it difficult to live without water. I think if you can't flush your toilets, you're having a pretty rough life.
Yeah.
And so I would find it very difficult to live without water. I love the internet, but I could live without the internet for a while. And electricity, we've all gone through probably 8 hours. I mean, I remember being here during an ice storm and hearing stories of people who didn't have electricity for 10 days. I think that would be incredibly difficult in the middle of winter. So there are, by the way, when you do vulnerability analysis and you try to estimate these consequences, you do consider in your calculations how recoverable a particular asset happens to be. And so recoverability does show up in the equation. The more difficult it is to recover the function that was provided, the service that was provided, the greater the consequences of losing that asset. And so you're getting at an interesting point.
Yeah, well, over here, we're at the point where we pretty much have to finish. We have a minute or two left. Generally speaking, how are we doing in terms of trying to address this issue that we have been talking about?
Well,
or maybe you say, well, it depends what system we're talking about. It depends about where we're talking about. It depends on what level of government we're talking about.
Well,
There's no straight answer.
One thing that has been happening is that throughout the country, cities and states have really put a lot of effort into trying to prioritize their assets and to identify what is critical. That is something that they weren't doing prior to 9/11. And so that has happened. And in many instances, when cities went out and tried to build network models and value their various assets, they have discovered things that were much more critical than they originally thought. And they have also discovered that some things were just ridiculously vulnerable. And so we have decreased the vulnerability of our infrastructure. Are we at risk? We are absolutely still at great risk. Everybody understands that a determined adversary will be able to take out parts of our infrastructure if they choose to do so.
There we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Thomas Mackin. He's professor, chair of the Department of Mechanical Engineering at Cal Polytechnic and State University, San Luis Obispo, California. He's also adjunct professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering Sciences here at University of Illinois. Thanks very much.
Thank you.